Welcome to Community Alert. Not if, but when. Positive preparation for disaster with Ted Adams and Mike Williams, keeping you informed on how to get ready and be prepared. Tuesdays at 11 a.m. and 9 p.m. and Saturdays at 1 p.m. on AM 1290, the Santa Barbara News Press radio station.
Good morning, folks. I'm Ted Adams. My co-host is Mike Williams. And today we're visiting with Dr. Glenn Miller, who's a psychiatrist in private practice here in Santa Barbara. He also writes an article for the News Press, Healthy Mind and Healthy Future. And today we're going to be talking about some of the things that are involved with suicide and a broad-based subject. And we're going to touch on some controversial things, but I hope it'll be interesting and not offensive to anyone. So.
Well, thank you, Doctor, for taking time to come in. Your last show on borderline personality disorder has been one of our more popular requested and talked about shows. And I think it touched a lot of nonprofits throughout the state. So,
well, it's a pleasure to be back. Thank you.
Thank you. Under announcements, flags of State Street. March is Red Cross Month, and flags are flying on State Street in honor of the Santa Barbara chapter. The American Red Cross provides support to victims of disasters, teaches life-saving skills, provides international humanitarian aid, and supports military members and their families, according to the news release recently released in Santa Barbara. For further information about the flag program or how you can help the Red Cross, give the Santa Barbara Downtown Association a call at 962-2098, 962-2098. And we just did an article about the Red Cross a week ago. They're in need of some help, and folks should give them a call and see what they can do for them. We're going to talk about suicide today, and there's been a variety of suicides here locally, and it kind of caught my attention. And we talk about disasters, floods, earthquakes, and all of those things, but for families, suicide's probably one of the biggest disasters they're ever going to have to face. And I suspect for the individuals that are suicidal, it's also a disaster, the trial and tribulation, the torment that they're going on internally. How do you communicate that? I want to talk about that a little bit today. I know personally I've been around a lot of suicide professionally, as a police officer, going to suicides, making death notifications, which is probably the worst part of the job totally, dealing with suicides with kids, with the elderly, which is a little bit different type of situation. My stepdaughter attempted suicide. My brother-in-law killed himself. One of my best friends killed himself. In fact, I work with quite a few people who have committed suicide. So I've seen it from a variety of different perspectives. So I'm sensitive to it. And in fact, we were on a call on 154 where the driver of the vehicle committed suicide, turned around and jumped off the bridge right in front of us. Kind of caught us by surprise at 5 o'clock in the morning. So, and suicide leaves all of this trail of rubble behind it. So you've got the individual that has an issue, and then that subsequently creates a lot of head trips for others. I mean, with fatalities in a car accident or a shooting or a stabbing, something like that, as tragic as those things are, at least there's a reason. You can say, he did this to that person. Suicide, you don't have any of those kinds of definitions. It's like, what could I have done? What it caused this? Is it my fault? Those kinds of questions. So that leads me into my first question. We all know what suicide is, but we don't know what suicide is. From a clinical point of view, what is suicide?
Well, again, suicide, as we do all know, is the intentional taking of one's own life. Okay. That being said, there are such things as unintentional suicide. When we talked at our last time I had the honor of being here, when we talked about borderline personality disorders and the cutting behavior that is sometimes common in that disorder, sometimes mistakes are made and they end up unintentionally taking their own life, which is still a suicide.
Technically,
it's the
yes.
taking of one's own life.
But it goes against the nature of any living thing to stay alive and to survive. Where does that flaw start to take place?
It does go against the nature of survival, and that is what we do. I mean, when we're underwater, we struggle with all our might to get to the surface because we want to survive, which, if you would, underscores the type of pain and desperation these individuals are experiencing in order for them to actually go counter to something that is so deeply ingrained in our genetic code, that is to survive. So, and it's important, I think, for the listeners to really understand, as you pointed out, Mike, that tragic, unexpected loss, death, is hard for any family and friends to deal with, even for a community to deal with. But then we can somehow rationalize it. Well, the car spun out of the control. The brakes didn't work. The driver was drunk and on the wrong side of the freeway. and on and on and on. Accidents, we can say, happen. They do. And we can accept it for the most part and then try and move on with our lives. What suicide brings to families, to friends, to a community is a sense of guilt that goes along with that loss that is very unique to suicides and that loss. Because now the question is, why? Not just, oh, it's an accident. Why? Why and what did I miss? What could I have done different?
For me, the suicide issue goes a lot deeper in that. I think that our feeling about suicide as a society is basically, we talked a little bit about this before the show, has a lot to do with our consideration about what death represents and our aversion to death and how we've been told to fear death and all the things that organized religion puts on the other side of death that threatens us and all that sort of thing. I think that if we had more confidence in ourselves and what death represents, perhaps we would be more understanding. Because to me, suicide is actually the ultimate expression of freedom. You know, that the individual has ultimately always that available to them. It's very sad that they choose that because many times it's unnecessary and that life takes different paths all the time, and to figure that life is no longer going to take a path to your benefit, so you're going to take your own life. But that is in itself the ultimate expression of individuality and individual freedom. I wonder how you feel.
Well, and that's a very interesting point. And in counseling people that have had strong suicidal ideations, we do address, there is a very strong religious and, if you would, belief system behind that. As you may well, both well know, and the listeners may know, that there are cultures in this world where suicide is a highly acceptable form of death. And although our rates of suicide, which we might have a chance to talk to later, are still way high, they pale in comparison to many countries in other parts of the world where really suicide is an acceptable societal form of ending one's life. Because as we all know, it is not a matter of if, it's just a matter of when.
Yeah. Right. Well, the idea that for me, the younger the individual is that chooses that course, the more tragedy that's involved, because the opportunity for life to take a different turn for them.
Yes.
And then when you see the teenagers that are committing suicide because of something that came up on Facebook or on YouTube or something like that, and this bullying thing and all that business, there's a tremendous amount of tragedy there.
And it's very different, Ted. And teenage suicides in general are very impulsive acts, very impulsive acts. Whereas amongst adults, and especially older adults, it is not so impulsive. It is much more typically a well thought out and deeply considered act to either end pain and suffering or to have, as Mike, you point out, the ultimate sense of control over their destiny. For an example, in a terminal cancer patient, not wanting to let others have to make that difficult decision for him or her, not wanting to leave that ultimate decision in the hands of medical professionals.
So does a DNR, do not resuscitate, could that be construed as another just form of suicide? I mean, technically it's not because it's a legal document, but you are authorizing people to either act or not do anything at all.
Right. You're giving people permission to let nature take its course. And those decisions are also fraught with lots of difficulty because I've worked with many patients in the hospital setting where the patient is determined they want that DNR and family members who are just unwilling to be able to let go are fighting the patient to not have to sign.
Well, and I had some of that. Well, not with my particular mother. I mean, it was but I've seen a lot of that with other families that I've been with, and it's very, very difficult. Which brings up another show, and that's your
Let's
planning.
Pick it up after the break.
Yeah, we'll come up on the break. Talking today to Dr. Glenn Miller, author of A Healthy Mind and a Healthy Future, on KZSB AM 1290 Community Alert. We'll be right back.
Folks, welcome back to Community Alert. I'm Ted Adams. My co-host is Mike Williams. And today we're talking to Dr. Glenn Miller, who's a psychiatrist in Santa Barbara. And he writes an article for the News Press. It's called Healthy Mind, Healthy Future. And we're talking about suicide, a subject that we're going to have a hard time covering in the time allotted to us today. And perhaps we'll be able to talk more about it. Our phone lines are open, 564-1290. Give us a call if you got any observations or questions. And, Mike, you've got something you want to bring up here.
Well, Doctor, when we talk about suicide, what kind of numbers are we talking about? How does this equate to causation of death overall? And what are we looking at here locally in Santa Barbara?
Well, what happens in the mental health field is that approximately every 5 years, when it comes to suicide, we do retrospective studies. And so the last numbers that we have available to us are from back in 2007, because 2012 will be another benchmark year, mm-hmm. and approximately sometime toward the end of 2013, we'll have those numbers. Mm-hmm. But going back to 5 years ago, to 2007, in the United States alone, there were just approximately 35,000 deaths that were claimed to have been suicide. Okay? My impression, and talking with my colleagues, is that the true number is actually much higher than that,
right.
because
right.
many single motor vehicle accident deaths are actual suicides. They're just not identified
right.
as such.
There's no
in the
note
records.
Or anything. It's an act that people just
do. Right.
And you know, to interject, the cops do look for that.
Course,
that mm-hmm. is not. You would think they wouldn't, but there's signs of suicide in traffic accidents that are not obvious to the untrained eye, and they do look for that because you're right. It is common.
It is a common experience, and as such, suicide actually ranked back in 2007 as the 11th leading cause of death in the United States. However, amongst young people, amongst teenagers, it actually ranks third. As the cause of death. So that kind of prevalence in that particular age group, the impulsive, if you would, mm-hmm. teenage age group, is much, much higher. In Santa Barbara County, there were, again, 2007, there were a total of 28 suicides in the county back in 2007, and which we do the estimates of how many, if you would, years of life lost. Figuring out what the average life expectancy is, it came to about 725 years mm-hmm. of life lost amongst those 28.
And, of course, again, when you're saying those 28 people, those are the 28 that you can really identify as being suicide.
Yes, again.
You're
mm-hmm.
right.
And those are the ones that we
So they break
know
it down
of.
As to age group and to reasons like health problems or depression or, I mean, do they break it down into categories that way or is it – Or those are not easily identifiable.
Those are not easily identifiable yeah. as our, you know, so when it comes to statistical analysis, they don't break them down that way.
Mm-hmm.
What we do know is that the vast majority of people that do suicide are suffering from significant mental health issues, typically depression, and most of which are either undiagnosed or have been diagnosed and are being untreated.
There's an area here that I like to cover, which is another area that could take us, you know, at least an hour to talk about. But that's the so-called psych drug phenomenon, and the drugs that are prescribed for all the way from children of, you know, 3 or 4 years old all the way through the lifetime. Mm-hmm. And then when those drugs are misprescribed or that they don't fit the individual and are terminated, that it causes depression. And there's a lot of suicide that's attached to that, as I understand. Maybe you could talk to us a little bit about
that. Yeah, it's an interesting construct that has been developed around antidepressant medications over the last decade or so. A lot of it was, I think, in response to legal actions that were taken against drug companies and some prescribing doctors.
Mm-hmm.
And what often happens with depression, and this has been going on now for a long, long time, I mean, decades, not just the new antidepressants, is that many people that suffer from severe depression have what we call a vegetative depression. They're very listless, very lethargic. They have no motivation. They don't sleep, they don't eat, they don't do anything. They literally just, if you would, vegetate.
Right.
And hence the name. What happens is that they become, you know, they're identified, they get treatment, and they've all along in this vegetative state been very depressed and have had suicidal ideations and thoughts. But they really haven't had the wherewithal, because of their depression, to act upon them. So now we administer a medication that's going to get them better. And as they start getting better, okay, they still have not cleared their depression yet. But they start getting better. They start having a little bit more energy, a little bit more wherewithal, a little bit more focus and stuff. And then that is when they're at the greatest risk. They're not at the greatest risk at the depth of their depression. They're at the greatest risk as they come out of it. It's not so dissimilar with some of the eating disorders, with severe anorexics. When they start what we call refeeding, when you start bringing them back, their body, that's when they're at the greatest risk of actually dying from physical causes, because their body has adjusted in such a way that if you feed them a normal meal, it could literally kill them.
Interesting. Okay?
And so it's on the upswing. It's as they're getting better, they're at their greater risk. Now, there are some reports where people had unique reactions to some of the newer antidepressant medications. So they're still depressed, but the medications made them now agitated and anxious. Okay? So again, and just to clarify for the listener, is that deep depression is a great indicator of potential suicide.
Mm-hmm.
What's even greater is when the severely depressed patient also is anxious and agitated. Because the severely depressed patient alone tends to just be vegetative and want to just pull the covers over their head and not do anything. It's the discomfort, the severe discomfort that anxiety produces that really puts the depressed patient at greater risk.
Well, there's a lot of information out there through documentaries, and I mean, I've seen them. They're up on, you can download them on Netflix or whatever, about some of the things that have happened with people with this depressive and administrating the drugs. And mm-hmm. a lot of times the finger is pointed at the psychiatric community because they say that we don't know enough about the workings of the brain, and they admit that we do not know how mm-hmm. the mind and the brain are hooked together. And so what happens is someone shows up with a problem, and they will prescribe a drug, but that they don't really have knowledge that that drug is going to treat that condition other than it has worked for others, and so we'll try it for – like there's kind of a shotgun approach rather than a scientific approach, and that idea is developing within the general public, and I'm not sure that that's the case, and I'd kind of like to hear you address that.
It may well be developing within the general public, the general population. Mm-hmm. I do not see that being practiced in the mental health field here in our community. I can't speak to
Good.
Other communities.
Good. Well, that's a real positive.
In that, in our community, and I know a number of the psychiatrists and practitioners that are working with the mental health and within the mental health field, that it is a much more scientific and a scientific approach, in that when I see a patient with depression, I'm going to aggressively treat that disorder because I understand the risk of it getting worse and the potential risk of the suicide.
Mm-hmm.
So I make sure that when I start patients on antidepressants, my contacts with them are much more frequent in the first 2 to 6 weeks than they will be after that time, because that's the time that they're at greatest risk when they're starting to come out mm-hmm. of it.
I think the publication that I'm thinking of are that when they're treating these very young children with these things, the parents feel that the child is not realizing his potential or that he has some sort of a depressive, and you know, they get Ritalin or they get, you know, all these things, and there's a feeling within the public that these things shouldn't be prescribed at these times and all that sort of stuff. And
yeah, I'm not sure that really how much of that necessarily leads to suicide as it is the whole issue of over-medicating children,
right.
Which I think is another hour.
Yeah, yes. I'm sure. Okay. Sorry about that. I didn't mean to
That's okay.
So.
Well, we're coming up to our next break. We're visiting today with Dr. Glenn Miller, Healthy Mind, Healthy Future. I want to thank our sponsors, California Fire Safe Council, Cold Spring Tavern, Santa Barbara, California, is one of their finest restaurants, 967-0066, and, of course, Arts and Letters backing that up. Service Master Anytime, 688-2399, California State Firefighters Association, the Fire Services Training Institute, and, of course, we have our friends down at the Montecito Emergency Response Recovery Action Group. On Community Alert, Ted Adams, Mike Williams, and the ever-diligent Richard Dugan working the slide plots and watching the clock for us on Community Alert, Not If But When, Positive Preparation for Disaster, on KZSB AM 1290, your Santa Barbara News Press Radio, live on the Internet at newspress.com.
Folks, welcome back to Community Alert. I'm Ted Adams. My co-host is Mike Williams. And today we're talking with Dr. Glenn Mennel, who's a psychiatrist locally, and talking about many things to do with people taking their own lives and the reasons for it and some of the things that can be done to prepare people to prevent that sort of thing and how it affects us all. I mean, this is a situation that covers many hours.
This stuff fascinates me, and it for a variety of different reasons on a professional level and a personal level. But let's get into what people need to know. Your workmate. Let's start in the work world, because I think that's where we interact with the most people. Mm-hmm. What are some signs that people can look for that would suggest maybe the person they're working with or around or come in contact with might have some issues? And I mean, not the obvious stuff that I want to go and jump off the bridge, but the right. subtle things. What are we looking for?
Well, there's any type of significant change in, like, behaviors and personality in particular, which may be an indication of a deepening depression, where the maybe typical happy-go-lucky guy at work becomes much more pessimistic. There's a sense of hopelessness and despair. Again, if someone who has those signs and also has some frank anxiety, that's a much, in my opinion, in my professional opinion, that's a much greater risk factor because of that kind of pervasive discomfort that creates an individual. There's more motivation to escape, if you would, that kind of pain and discomfort. If they become more impulsive in their behaviors around the workplace, at home, that's something to be considered. Also, if you notice a meaningful increase in either alcohol consumption or they begin using drugs, exactly. These are all kind of signs that add up to someone who is at greater risk.
Self-medication is what that
is. Exactly right. And then some of the more obvious ones is, you know, someone going out and trying to get a firearm when they're acting like that. Mm-hmm. They start giving away things. You know, you have a 17-year-old giving away their favorite, you know, CD collection or giving away their favorite posters. These are kind of things that really need to get attention. If I could just give one very brief vignette of how something so obvious can get missed if you don't take the step back. When I was working in the emergency room, this is going way back, this is back in the Chicago area, I had a mother bring in her 15-year-old son who had attempted suicide. So I was called in, evaluating the patient, talking to the mom, and she says to me, and this is all in a sense in one breath, you know, I found it kind of weird that he asked me about getting a life insurance policy on himself. And I said, well, when did that happen? She said, well, that was a few days ago. And I asked her, I said, well, what did you do? And she said, well, I called the insurance broker, and he said that we really don't write insurance policies for 15-year-olds. And then in the next breath, she says, how would I have ever seen this attempt coming?
Mm.
Okay. This is the kind of denial that we can be in, not only as parents, but as friends as mm-hmm. well, because we don't want to see that. We can't really go there in our own hearts and minds that someone would be at such risk or in such pain.
I think one of the things about suicide is that people take responsibility for it. You know, and the whole thing we talk about the idea that the missed cue and all the things that lead up to it, and why didn't we know more or better about this was going to happen. But I think, on the other hand, that it doesn't really enter into our reality. It's almost like emergency preparedness, you know. I mean, it is. I mean, you've got to be aware of these things in order to be able to read the signs. And if you're not really aware and you're not paying attention, then it's all going to go right by you until the event occurs and you're not prepared.
That's exactly right. That's a very good analogy. Very good analogy.
Well, I think it's true of all of us. Don't we have to, in the back of, you got to have yourself firmly rooted in a corner of your life and your emotions to know that you're stable in what you, how you're going to deal with the surprises that come down life's happy little trail. And not everybody's that well clipped in and that secure. And it doesn't take much, I should think, to stir people and get them all of a sudden derailed and start thinking weird thoughts.
Well, and that's, and that point is spot on, because, which is why we see such a higher prevalence of suicide amongst young people, amongst teenagers, who really who have all of the same senses and emotions that we have as adults. They have fear, they have depression, they have anxiety, they have joy, they have all the whole breadth of emotions we have as adults, but they don't have the tools of life experience and problem solving and alternative ways of coping that we have by the time we've reached adulthood.
So the things that happen to them are much more in front for them. And the public, the way that their peers judge them is so much more overwhelming to them than it is to someone that has had some life experience and is more apt to deal with that.
And has gotten through the challenges, has learned adaptive skills that only comes with living life.
That's right.
And that's, again, why, and I work quite a bit with younger people. My area of specialty is in child, adolescent, and young adult psychiatry, and the impulsive nature of my kids makes for some real sleepless nights sometimes.
Oh, bad. Well, it seems to me that with the kids, a lot of seems like they do it with no idea of what the finality is of the act, and they're thinking about how their friends are going to react to the situation because they've seen perhaps someone else do it and how much attention that person draws, and they want the attention, and so, and they don't think about the ramifications of them not actually going to be there to get the attention. It's more about, well, I'll, you know.
Right. Well, and also you have to remember that young people, we have to be very honest, young people lives are, they live in extremes. It's like the worst day of my life, Dad. Or this is like the best thing that's ever happened ever. They don't have a lot of gray yet. Gray comes with age and maturity. And so when they're challenged in a negative way, it really does become the worst thing that could ever happen.
And based on what they know at that
based on what they know and how what they experience at that time. And if it's the worst thing that could ever happen, and there's no sense that it can ever change, not only is it good and bad is extreme, but it's like tomorrow is like forever. Again, it's a life of extremes at adolescence.
Right. Yeah.
Do you find that with suicide that blogs and the internet and Facebook and gaming, I see kids that have just enmeshed themselves in the gaming phenomena, and then all of a sudden that's gone, but that's become their life. It's become more than just an activity that eats away time. This is now their life. The people that live vicariously through all these TV shows and stuff, what happens when that's removed? Does that promote some of this suicidal thinking?
I'd have to give that a lot more thought. I'm not sure that it would necessarily promote suicidal thinking. Where I do think that technology lends credence to suicidal issues is the ability, especially in young people, to critique, criticize, and bully from a now an arm's length and a visual length away in a way that our generation, those of us, well, Richard, you're way too young, but the rest of us sitting around the table here would be able to, you know, would have experienced. I mean, if someone was going to bully us, they had to do it to our face when we were kids.
Schoolyard, yeah.
Now they don't.
Well, they're protected by the electronic wall, and and so.
But the emotions aren't. The people are. But the key here is that other people's emotions are not any more protected. Because it's an arm length.
Well, and they identify so much with all of these websites that they're involved with.
Well, our whole society is becoming electronic, and there is no emotion in that. Maybe there's emotion within the contents and how it's perceived. That's why email is so dangerous.
That's exactly
because if you start reading email at its face and you start trying to inject it, it can mean many different things to different people. All the more reason don't send email. I mean, with that thought, we're talking to Dr. Glenn Miller today. Healthy Mind, Healthy Future on KZSB AM 1290. Community Alert, not if, but when. Positive preparation for disaster. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Community Alert, folks. I'm Ted Adams. My co-host is Mike Williams. And during the break, we get so involved, we forget the programs going on here. Today, we're visiting with Dr. Glenn Miller, who's a psychiatrist here in Santa Barbara, has a program here at AM 1290, Healthy Mind, Healthy Future. And we're talking about suicide and a lot of things that do with mental health, and a very interesting program here.
One of the things I wanted to talk about a little bit, it's a phenomenon that I'm starting to see, and that is women in general, and I don't know statistically, but certainly locally this is true, taking more violent suicidal approaches than women have historically done in the past. Women were good for pills and overdosing in various forms and slitting their wrist in the bathtub, and, you know, stuff that wouldn't cosmetically look bad. Now we see them trying to drive over cliffs and jumping out in front of cars and walking down railroad. These are violent, traumatic ways to die. What's causing that?
It's a very interesting point, and there have been discussions in some of the psychiatric forums about this kind of issue. There's obviously, as we've talked about off there too, in the mental health arena, we don't have the luxury of knowing exactly a lot of times, but we can oftentimes put forth some pretty good hypothesis. And what the thought is of, and it is very true that we are seeing much more what we would typically consider male forms of suicide being attempted and being successful at amongst women. That includes gunshot wounds, that includes motor vehicle accidents, intentionally driving off a cliff or into an embankment, hanging also, which we tend to think of as more male type of suicide, whereas overdosing on pills with alcohol, some wrist cutting kind of things tend to be more in the realm of the female, is that over the last several decades, there has been a narrowing of the gender gap, if you would.
More equality.
More equality, and more even in our society, in our culture, we are less divided in quote-unquote normal male-female roles as we had back in the mid-50s, like sure. Back in the mid-1900s. And so with that comes some, if you would, coming to the middle of the types of behaviors we see and more violent suicides in females. But also, in general, there's been somewhat of an uptick in the actual number of violent suicides across the spectrum, both male and female. And again, we can only hypothesize, but there's a strong feeling that a lot of that has to do with the exposure to violence, which is relatively new in the last 20 years in the media. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, we now see violence on television that wouldn't have even probably played out in movie theaters back in the late 60s and 70s.
Right.
I'm curious, too. I was on the phone this weekend. There's a great report that just came out for the city of San Jose, written by IBM, and it just blasts public safety and the costs and the changes. And the city of San Jose has been laying off city employees very aggressively for several years, and they're getting ready to lay off another large percentage of them. These are professional people from across the board, police, fire, building inspectors, city administrators and stuff. And now they've all bought heavy because they do get paid well, but they're all now starting to lose their homes. Literally, these people making $150,000 are still losing their homes and all these things. We can argue and debate why all that is. But the thing that it caused me to think about as it relates to our discussion here is these people have nowhere to go. They're too old now to start over. The lady I was talking to, you know, she's got two kids. They're all being accepted into major universities, but there's no way to pay for it. Her house is in foreclosure, and she's making $100,000+ a year, but she is making less today than she was when she started working for the city 25 years ago. And I'm thinking, you extrapolate that out across the population of the country, millions of people going through this, and I'm seeing some of these folks are not seeing a lot of alternatives. Are we going to start seeing some significant rises in suicide and mental health issues that kind of fall in that same jurisdiction?
The short answer is yes. Those, when we talk at conferences, again, the numbers won't be out for another probably 18 months because we'll review them at the end of 2012. But we've all been seeing in all major communities and cities throughout the country increase in rates of suicide. And that's because there is, with the economic downturn, which has been about 5 years now, there's been a dramatic increase, not only in the sense of desperation, but in the sense of hopelessness. when it's short-lived, you can be desperate, but there's hope because we'll ride through this six-month or year-long wave and it'll be better on the other side. It's when the desperation gets combined with the hopelessness that is it ever going to get better? You know, it's like, oh, it'll be better soon, and then it's not. Oh, it'll be better soon, and then it's not. And then you start questioning, well, when is it going to get better? And another year goes by, and another year goes by, and then it
Because it continues to degrade over that period of time, so it's not getting better, it's getting worse all
and
the
then
time.
And then you add to that mix the sense of hopelessness. And when you have desperation and hopelessness, it is a very dangerous mix.
I think it's compounded when you have somebody that's been in a position of responsible charge. They've had employees under them. They've had title. They've had recognition, what have you. You see, obviously, in the military, law enforcement, fire, that kind of thing. But you have that same hierarchy mentality in lots of other areas. And now, all of a sudden, you're not able to get a job because you're overtrained, you're overeducated. You're competing with people that are just getting out of college who are much more computer savvy and perhaps a little more attractive than an experienced person. There's nowhere for you to go.
That's very true. But what also gets added to that is that we've seen what we think we're going to find out in when we do our retrospective, is that even if you would higher socioeconomic class increase in suicide even greater than the rest of the population. Because if you would, when there's a fall, the higher you are, the farther you fall. But also there's been a lot of discussion over the fact that people in higher socioeconomic structure tend to be ones that are credited and expected to be the problem solvers. They're the ones that are leading business. They're mid and upper management. This is what they do all day long, is they problem solve. And this is a problem they can't solve.
Yeah.
Which is leading to, again, even greater desperation, a bigger fall, and greater hopelessness.
What do you recommend to if I came into you and I said, I've worked for the city of so-and-so, or I work for a big, large corporation for the last 26 years. I have three kids that are getting ready to go to university. I've just lost my job. I'm 4 months behind on my mortgage. My wife has got some issues. I don't have any more health insurance, and I've got high blood pressure, cholesterol, so I'm on the fast track to, you know, cardiovascular problems. And I just lay this whole scenario out. Not as an alarmist or a whiner, but I'm just responding to the litany of questions that you would probably ask. What do you say to somebody like that?
Well, commit suicide.
No, one of my favorite sayings is we see more and more that it's not just, well, I'm having this particular problem that I'd like to really try and get a handle on. It's a litany. It is a grocery list of problems. And what I try and remind people, and this is just more of a life thing too, is that when you feel like that elephant is crushing you, if you try and eat the elephant all at once, you will inevitably choke on it. So you have to eat it one bite at a time, and you will sooner or later get it all down. Okay? And what it really does, what I spend a lot of time doing, is helping individuals, if you would, prioritize their lists of oh my gods, okay, and what to do, and then having to literally approach them one at a time and helping them get comfortable with the self statement of I'm doing the best I can and I can do no more.
You know, we talk about organizations on this show a lot, too, because there's individual suicides, but organizations can be suicidal, too. And I can think of many that are just the diamond laying like meteorites through space, ready to slam into the first thing in their path on the suicidal, the hell and die mentality, because they just think that's the only thing that's available to them. And I think the idea that we stress consistently is have a plan.
Absolutely.
And I think factoring it down, just like we did in English class, I don't know if they do diagramming sentences anymore, but when you break it all down to individual components, some of those components actually don't matter.
Right. And prioritize, I think that's what you said.
Prioritize, and then when you see that you have a plan, all of a sudden that hopelessness starts diminishing.
Well, now
you got control. Because now you have control.
That's
exactly
why we
right.
encourage people to have lists in their homes when there's a disaster, because they're so freaked out, and if they feel like they're forgetting something, if they've got a list to go through, then it gives them something to do, and exactly. also they know they're not
meeting anything. Well, speaking of fatigue and anxiety, our controller over here is starting to throw a seizure. Talking today with Dr. Glenn Miller, Healthy Mind, Healthy Future on Community Alert. Ted Adams, Mike Williams, we'll be right back. You're listening to KZSB AM 1290.
Welcome back to Community Alert, folks. I'm Ted Adams. My co-host is Mike Williams. And today we're visiting with Dr. Glenn. Where am I? Dr. Glenn Miller. Sorry. Glenn.
We're talking about the black pill. It may be time.
Yeah, we had another interesting break here. Dr. Miller is a psychiatrist in private practice here in Santa Barbara, and he writes an article for the News Press, Healthy Mind and Healthy Future. And we've been exploring suicide in the last hour, and just really an interesting, fast hour.
It's been a very fast hour, yes.
You know, I'd like to kind of close out with what your thoughts, the message you want to get out for suicide prevention, what people need to be thinking. But I think that people tend to want to deny this. They don't want to deal with it. It has to do with your own longevity and your own situation. It's the reality of the human condition. We're cursed, if you will, with the idea that it's not going to last forever, and yet we do everything in our power to deny death,
right.
And that everything about our society is the denial of death. We've never accepted it, and we certainly don't want to deal with somebody else's unacceptance. And yet, we're trying to provoke people into stopping and saying, "Wait a minute! There's some things in life that you actually have to deal with, and this is certainly one of them."
Well, and to also just for listeners, for something to kind of think about as they go on through the day and the week, is that there are those different types of suicides. You know, the elderly person who's been, you know, in their late 70s, 80s, who's fraught with terminal cancer, who in a final way to take control of their life chooses to end their life by their own hand, is very different than impulsive 14-year-old, as I mentioned, who steps out in front of a train because they were jilted by a boyfriend or girlfriend. And so, you know, that's maybe for another time a discussion about that. There are, I believe, both personally and professionally, there are some reasonable and positive and caring ways that people can be assisted in ending their life at the end, in their end stages of life, that are not only an act of professionalism, but it's an act of love. You know, I was mentioning to Mike, and I think you, Ted, when we were out in the waiting area before the show, that, you know, every time I've had to put one of my dogs down over the years, which have been way too many, every time I've done that, I've always thought to myself, and sometimes I've actually verbalized, I hope that when my time at the end of my life comes, someone loves me enough, that really loves me enough to do this for me as well.
Well, amen. So.
My mother died of pulmonary fibrosis and pneumonia, and that is not a way that you want to go.
Right.
And fortunately, she was in Vermont, not in California. But I remember in EMT school way back when I was much younger than now, watching a lady die in the hospital from emphysema, same kind of thing. And I agree with you completely. That, but I don't even think of that as suicide. I just don't.
Right. But for those, and I want to make sure before we end, that for those that we're talking about, when we talk about suicide, those that we really, that aren't at the end of their life.
Right.
Okay? Mm-hmm. The ones, those young people, those ones that just in a moment of either impulsiveness, desperation, hopelessness, and really have a whole life left ahead of them.
Mm-hmm.
It's really important that the listener understand that suicide can be prevented. We have to keep our eyes open. We have to keep our ears open. We have to keep our hearts open.
I think there's a difference between suicide and euthanasia, and I think that we're talking about euthanasia with the old and all, everyone else is with
right. Although the elderly, it may be at their own hand,
yes,
technically.
Right.
But there is, just to remind everyone that there is the countrywide, there's the 211 suicide hotline, like we have the 911 emergency hotline. There is the 211 suicide hotline throughout the country. So if you someone close to you, a friend, a family member, you feel is at risk of suicide, it's 211.
Give them a call, and there's someone to talk to.
Right. And in Santa Barbara County, we have a hotline also. The number is 888-868-1649.
If you see something, say something. If you have a friend that needs some help, be a real friend. Don't deny it. Go do something for him. Visiting today with Dr. Glenn Miller, a fast show, Healthy Mind, Healthy Future on Community Alert. Ted Adams, Mike Williams, and Richard Dugan on the board. Until next week, you're listening to Community Alert, not if but when, positive preparation for disaster. KCSB AM 1290, the news is next. We'll see you next week.
This has been Community Alert, not if, but when. Positive preparation for disaster with Ted Adams and Mike Williams. Community Alert is produced by the Wildland Residents Association, San Marcos Pass Volunteer Fire Department, and sponsored by the California Fire Safe Council. Technical support for Community Alert provided by Richard Dugan and Jim Williams. Community Alert, not if, but when. On KZSB AM 1290, your news press radio station.